accession number 20456, reel 17.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 17. You were saying that the syllabus of training for weapon training was entirely changed.
Well, it was very much revised and brought up to date. And you see, in your self-loading rifle was just beginning to come in. And that meant a change of tactics and change of emphasis on training. G.V. Britton, he was a Northamptonshire regiment. He was a busy rifle shot.
How did the self-loading rifle change tactics?
How what?
How did it change tactics?
Well, it could produce a far greater volume of fire, much quicker than the breech-loading rifle. And what is more, you could fire it from the hip, which meant that in the jungle things, you had to learn a snap shooting technique rather than a bolt action snap. Yeah.
Did you encounter opposition in introducing that change, bringing snap shooting?
Well, I was too junior, really, to know. I don't think there was. Finally, opposition. When the self-loading rifle came in, the guards looked at it with displeasure because they couldn't quite see how they could do the drill that they'd been accustomed to for years. And there was a serious paper put up by, I'm told, headquarters of the guards, that they should retain the old-fashioned rifle. Who was a duel this smarter. But that, I'm told, has happened in history before.
It certainly happened subsequently. Then there was a great deal of concern when they decided to get rid of the self-loading rifle and bring in the SAA.
I know. Oh, yes.
Very short.
Well.
Compared to the old SLR.
I know. Well, there we are. Things, you know, never change in this world. But I remember going on there, and Richard Gale said, "Yeah, me," he said, "you know, why don't we go to the bow and arrow and do drill as they did at Cressy, you know?" And he said, "Actually, in many ways, a much more efficient weapon than the self-loading rifle." However,
in the hands of the
public school. That was your problem. But the most of my work at the War Office was to do with the manning, organization, and times, you know, the programs that these guys were doing. Each regiment had what they called a primary training center, where the guys went for the first 8 weeks, or 12, I can't remember. And then they went to what they called an infantry training center, which was for another 6 weeks, and then they were posted to their units. So you had 18 weeks, basically, training in two stages. And the PTCs got them fit, taught them to shoot, were able to drill, but the infantry training centers taught them to operate in units of platoons and companies.
Were these places co-located, or were they?
Yes, they were. Well, basically speaking, if you think of Scotland, you had infantry training centres in the old regimental depots like Cameron's, Inverness, Blackwatch, Perth, ourselves, Stirling, Highlight Infantry, Glasgow. The infantry training centre was way up at on the coast, north coast, I can't remember now. And they all went there, you know. They all married up there.
Where did you actually get the instructional staff in these places? Were they drawn from the regiment concern?
They were all drawn from the regiment concern. And here you see we had the first of the problems in that your regular staff, sergeants and people and corporals, were looking over their shoulders to be released from the army. And one was only just about able to compete because they then extended the national service from 2 years to 3 years. So we were able to get quite a lot of what I would call third-year NCOs who were good. And sometimes people forget it. The actual intake of ability and skill and mental ability, particularly of national servicemen, was far higher than the old regular army used to deal with in pre-war days. So you had a lot of very high-grade chaps.
Did you find that they were eager to become instructors of these training centres?
Well, some weren't. That was a problem. Your best chaps almost inevitably turned.
What did they want to do with themselves?
Well, they wanted to get back into civilian. They didn't want to commit themselves too much. They loved the army. It wasn't they didn't like the army. They didn't want to commit themselves too much.
Was recruiting generally into the regulars going reasonably well in this era of national service? Were you able to get men to sign on?
Well, as a regiment, we didn't do badly. We had a lot of... The big thing was to get them to sign on for 3 years.
Yeah.
If you got them for 3 years, most of them would tend to stay on.
Re-engage.
Yes.
Longer.
Yes. Yes.
Did that also apply to other regiments? Or was
right across the board. Right across the board. There was, if you remember, they had a personnel management scheme where you started with A's, who were your sort of officers, intelligence corps and so on, B, who were the senior NCOs, and then you had the difference in C plus and C minus, and there was your dividing line, and there were never enough C pluses.
These would be good pilots.
Well, a bit more than that, you know. The C minuses were not of the same standard.
So, would the C pluses expect to do?
Well, your C pluses were your section commanders. They could be your mortarmen. They could be your signalers.
Yeah.
The C minuses really could do none of that.
Another thing you say is you had 3 years.
But I mean, this was a section commander throughout the whole services, Navy, Army, and Air Force.
Yeah.
And it was always the C pluses we were after.
Yeah. And never enough of them.
Never. But there just weren't enough in the country. Didn't say much for our educational system in those days.
But perhaps the army should have adjusted its grading to take account of the realities.
Because let us say you have the establishment of an infantry division, which needs 70 signalers, 70 cooks, 70 fitters, 70 driver mechanics, etc., etc., etc. Unless you have the standard of people who you can train to fill those posts, you are going to fail. And that's there was always this business of the lack of this particular category.
I don't suppose there was anything you could do about it, though, was there? Was it just
nothing? Nationally, it was a problem. You see, we had coal mining going on. You had the railways. I mean, you know, if you think of the number of men employed on the railways and coal mines, we just didn't have that type of guy, or enough of that different type of guy. You could train some of the others up to take their place, but not immediately.
Take them longer, presumably,
yes,
to get to the same standard.
Not too long.
Another thing you say is that you had 3 years in Whitehall, which is a long time for a posting, that you were not the Whitehall type. What is the Whitehall type?
Hmm.
What are the characteristics?
Well, the Whitehall type is someone who... there are, to this day, a lot of officers who get away from the regimental duty and spend their time on the staff. They are very good at producing papers, producing arguments for, you know, high up. Because remembering that in Whitehall, you're not just dealing with your superior officers. From time to time, you have to deal with your civilians, viz. The government, viz., you know, the civil service and so on. And this takes a little bit of getting adjusted to.
And you prefer regimental duty, presumably?
Yes.
When you got posted to Hong Kong to rejoin, you said that, you know, you got the impression there was something brewing in the Far East.
Yes.
Where did you get that idea from? Was it from the newspapers or was it from official sources that you heard that there was something happening
in
Korea?
Well,
carry on.
One did see the Joint Intelligence Bureau papers who were talking then about, first of all, the problems with Japan, with America, and secondly, the problems with China and North Korea. And it was, the Korean situation was beginning to agitate a bit, yes. And equally, we had sent, if you remember, a whole division out to Hong Kong, to the frontier. So,
was this because there was considered to be a threat from China to
Very much so, there was a threat from China. Very much so. We couldn't hold the place, but at least we put up a brave face and said, well, here we are, a division of soldiers. You know, we never had a division of soldiers in Hong Kong before.
What were they intended to do? Were they going to try and hold the old gin drinkers line in the new territories?
Oh, no, they were going to try hold new territories. Yeah. Never have done it. Not with the Chinese army. We didn't know very much about them, the Chinese army in those days.
And you said the Americans are having trouble in Japan. What sort of trouble?
Well, Japan was feeling its muscle. Admittedly, the Americans had done marvels in recreating it. But as it got more and more economically powerful, it was beginning to be less subservient, as it were, to MacArthur's government. I mean, the Korean, if anything made modern Japan, it was a Korean War, because it was the main base for Korea, and made an absolute fortune out of as a main base material supply and all the rest of it. And of course, again, it woke the Americans up that the best defense against China was a modernized, reorganized Japanese armed forces.
And this is all contained in the briefing.
Well, it was beginning to come in, yes.
When you were posted, I mean, what were you told officially you were likely to be doing?
I was going to command support company of the 1st Battalion in Hong Kong. Well, they were part of the division that was there, yes.
When did you hear that this had all changed?
On the troop ship. In the middle of the Mediterranean. Mm. I mean, the battalion had been, the battalion in the middle section, 29 Brigade, had been stood by for Korea. By the time I got to Hong Kong, they'd left.
You mentioned you had 5 days to prepare to follow them on. What did you have to do in that 5 days to prepare for going
to
Korea?
Get tropical uniform, you know, dispose of my own kit that I wasn't going to use out there, the peacetime stuff, and meet a lot of old chums and get drunk. Funnily enough, one of which, you see, was Hugh Wrigley, my previous brigadier in Manila, who was ex-Indian Army originally, And he said, how much do you know about the North Koreans? And I said, nothing. And he said, well, you'll find it's going to be very much like the North West Frontier. And he said, for God's sake, don't stick in the valleys. Get up those hills.
Had he had experience of Korea?
No, but he knew about it.
Do you know how he knew about it?
No, well, I wouldn't know.
What was he doing at the time? Was he?
He was the trade commissioner in Hong Kong, which was the equivalent of high commissioner.
So he was no longer in the army?
He'd finished the army. Finished Australia's army.
Did anyone else in Hong Kong have any advice for you about Korea?
No.
Did you know anything?
Well, it would be a closed country. No one had ever got anyone near there, you see.
Did you know anything about Korea before you went there?
Nothing.
Apart from what?
Nothing.
I think you went there via Japan.
Yes.
What impression did you have of Japan when you got there?
Not much. Landed in Japan about 5 o'clock one evening and left at 6 next morning.
So it was only overnight then?
Yes, an overnight stay with the Australian Transit Camp, yes.
Right. And the first thing you mentioned, that once you got to the headquarters at Taegu, you found it very difficult to actually make contact with your battalion or brigade.
See, this was the great so-called 8th Army Advanced Headquarters at Taegu. And, I mean, the enemy were within 15 miles of them at Weiguan. And they were in some status where... American staff work is very odd. It can be meticulous, but ask anyone to give a sensible suggestion to an American staff officer, you probably won't get one, certainly not in those days. Yes, they knew there was a British brigade around somewhere. They knew it was attached to 1st Cavalry Division and under 7th Cavalry. But what they didn't know was really where they were. And no one knew where anyone was in those days. It was a state of advanced chaos.
Who were you dealing with when you were at that headquarters? Was there anyone?
Well, the sort of equivalent of Brigadier General Chief of Staff.
How did you eventually get in touch then? How did you manage to find
out? Oh, well,
he
did eventually.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yes. But so much of it was landline, which didn't exist, or you know. He had much weightier things on his mind. I mean, the North Koreans bloody nearly were breaking through at Weiguan, you know.
They'd already taken Seoul by that time, hadn't they?
What?
They had taken Seoul, hadn't they, by that time?
Oh, Lord, yes, we were way down in them. We were only 100 miles north of... Taegu is 100 miles north of Busan. I mean, we were right in a very small perimeter with the complete North Korean superiority in actual numbers of troops and certainly tanks.
I mean, did you know that at the time? Would you have aware
of that? Well, one realized it at the time, yes. When we went out there, no way. And it was the most disorganized war I've ever joined.
Was it more disorganized than Singapore when you went
first time? Much more. The story of the American Air Force shooting up its own headquarters the next morning, where they thought they were shooting the next time up down the road.
Well, you described two cases in which the American Air Force made mistakes of that sort, because they...
Well, the American Air Force did not make a mistake on 282.
It didn't.
The American Air Force were ordered to attack us by our own brigade headquarters, who didn't know what was going on. We're out of touch for all sorts of reasons.
Well, I was going to ask why that was, why they should have assumed that you had been overrun.
Because they couldn't get their vehicles over the river. They couldn't see from where they were. I mean, the American liaison officer, pilot, was with them. And the pilot said, look, we can see the screens.
Yes.
You know? And they were told, oh, the screens have been overrun, you know. I mean, this was a shocking failure of communications.
Because they'd had no definite information that you'd been overrun, had they?
Well, no, absolutely none whatsoever. Where they'd got it from, I don't know. The guy who gave the order, Douglas Reith was in my regiment, who was a brigade major, sadly enough, is now dead. Yeah. But I mean, at Stirling, we've got Brigadier Aubrey Coad's papers. My goodness me, they're worth reading. And, the mind boggles as to what was happening there.
Was there no means of communication between you and brigade headquarters at that time? Had they?
Well, yes, there was. I mean, we were in communication with brigade headquarters on the battalion net.
Yes.
It's difficult to describe things when the other guy can't see it.
Yeah.
And on the map, 282 looked like one feature. In fact, it wasn't. It was two features.
Yes. I think you were saying that the enemy had started infiltrating around your left flank.
Correct.
You were not, so you couldn't really do very much to assist the two forward companies.
We were an understrength battalion. We only had three companies.
Yes.
Two companies were up the hill.
Yes.
And I was holding the sort of foothills and the base.
Yes. And their positions have been infiltrated. I think you said that the enemy had been getting into the rear, in effect they were isolating the companies from each other.
Yes, we were. It was horrible. And at that stage we had no artillery support. Mm. The gunners that was another trouble, you see. The American way of commanding artillery is the gunners are entirely their own masters. And the two forward observation officers who'd gone up the hill initially were told to withdraw. Mm. And they were told
It does seem to me that it would have been better not to have attempted to expand the bridgehead until the motor ferry had been
repaired. That's it, you see.
With the benefit of hindsight.
Except you see that MacArthur by this time had been 6 or 7 days ashore at Incheon and was doing well with things. And the big cry was, for God's sake, smash your way through, boys. And the same sort of situation happened in Normandy when the follow-up was going on, when you've got pockets of Germans that did a lot of damage to us.
Mm.
Hill 112, I think, is one of the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, do you think then there's an element of sunray optimism involved in pushing you forward at that time?
You're quite right. You're absolutely dead right. Yeah.
So a risk was taken that in the event was...
Yeah, I mean, we really weren't doing... Except we were, I suppose, distracting Korean forces that would otherwise have been used to block the main spearhead that was going up on our right.
When you originally joined... You said that everything was different, that all except for one officer had changed since 1947, since you'd last seen them. Had the sort of overall character of the battalion changed because of that, or was it...
Well, I didn't think there were anything like it. You see, we had very few of the wartime soldiers left.
Yes.
Your senior NCOs. And we had a lot of super young. See, we lost almost more regular officers in Korea than we did in the whole of World War II. Regular officers, I know about, because they were all commanding platoons. Well, we lost a lot of that World War II experience. Mm. Initially, I didn't think they were quite on the mall quite as much as they had been when I last saw them. But then, after 282, we had a whole lot of reinforcements come out, and that changed the whole thing. NCOs and officers who were very experienced guys. And that did make one hell of a lot of difference.
Was it simply this matter of experience, of being applied, that made the change?
Yes. Oh. Yes.
And this is primarily World War II experience?
Well, not so much that, pals. They were people who had all worked together before, They knew each other.
A matter of cohesion, then.
Exactly.
Mm. What about the NCOs and warrant officers?
Well, the NCOs were very good. We still had a very large leavening of World War II NCOs. sergeants in the jail, and there was no problem with them at all. But your problem really was with your younger chaps who hadn't been in action before, plus your signalers who hadn't really, you know, operated under active service conditions.
Was it difficult to signal in Korea? What were, was the terrain a source of difficulty with getting signals?
Oh, God, yes. And the further north you went, the more difficult it got. Because you see, well, these very high mountains, that seriously blocked your wireless. And once you got on top of the high mountains, that was all right, then you've got to get down again.
I mean, did you find that Brigadier Wrigley's advice was good advice, that you should,
yes,
you should need to get on the tops?
Oh, yes. Yeah. See, that was the thing the Americans did not do. They would not, initially, until General Ridgway came out, get up the bloody hills. They thought that they could, you know, motor down the roads. And of course, with North Korea sitting in the hills, that's one objective they could not do.
Isn't it a principle of mountain warfare that you have to control the tops of the features for observation and the low ground for movement?
Of course, but the Americans were a mechanized army, and they thought that, you know, they didn't need to get on top of the hills. They'd be able to drive, you know, through these people. You can't, because you get yourself cut off. It wasn't until the Americans started using Koreans, which they'd called up in the Korean army, as porters. And we had no mules. We've done the mules in Korea. And we all battalions got about 100 Koreans as porters, who would carry up your ammunition and your food and things. Then you would get up the hills.
Had you had any contact with the Koreans much when, in, you know, when you arrived?
No.
The first few?
No. Strange language, strange people. No, absolutely nothing.
You said that on in your first position, you were deployed on the Nektong, and that in support you'd got the Middlesex,
yes,
and a, some American 105, six 105s, and that the companies and some of the platoons were not able to give mutual support.
No way.
Why was that? Was it simply they were too spread out?
Well, we had to hold such a vast front. I mean, between us and the Middlesex, which was actually part of the Middlesex, they produced a whole lot of Korean police.
Yes.
Who they formed the police company with the Middlesex. And you could see where they were, but there was a 5-mile gap between us. There was a 5-mile gap between myself and the company behind me. This is out of mortar range, you know.
Well, out of mortar range.
We had to hold what we could.
I mean, could you cover that, the ground between, by patrolling or by any other means?
Well, no, not really. Luckily, we the Koreans had run out of steam a bit. As I say, we had boots on the other leg. We were on top of the hills, and the Koreans were down the bottom. And they, in order to get on, they had to get at us, and that was not so easy for them by then. They couldn't use their tanks up the hills.
What was the Nektong like? What
it was a fairly wide river. I mean, snow flying. I mean, I suppose where I was holding, it was as broad. Well, you see that path going down behind the trees?
Yes.
Yeah, as broad as that.
That's several hundred yards,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Was it a fast river?
A what?
Fast river.
No. Down further, we could see them operating at night. They had the Koreans had a tank ferry, they had some sort of ferry, but out of range, couldn't do anything to it. It was miles away, but you would see it with all glasses, something going on.
What sort of positions were your company in? Were you in all-round defence on your hilltop?
Yes, very like North West Frontier, except you could dig, you didn't build sangers.
Did you have adequate stocks of wire to...
No wire.
So it's just any mines or anything of that sort? Or?
No, not much in the way of mines. No, we made our own mines, stuffing grenades in ration tins, you know, with the wire coming out.
Improvised.
Yeah.
It sounds rather like Burma again in some ways.
was indeed.
What sort of positions did you dig? Were they one-man pits or two-man pits?
No, they were two-man pits. I mean, I had a four-man pit.